the United States went to war with Spain for the stated purpose of freeing the Cuban people from the tyrannical Spanish colonial empire and to establish an independent Cuban republic. Yet the ironic result of that war was the creation of an overseas American colonial empire, with the acquisition from Spain of the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico, as well as the annexation during the war of Hawaii. Now, by the standard interpretation, this was our first and our last American experiment with overseas imperialism, what one prominent diplomatic historian, Samuel Flagg Bemis, labeled, quote, the great aberration. By this interpretation, the United States, being born in an anti-colonial revolt, opposed imperialism throughout its history, and in such statements as the Monroe Doctrine, sought to encourage anti-colonial Republican revolts elsewhere. Along with this anti-imperialism went a desire, as enunciated most clearly in Washington's 1796 farewell address, to remain isolated from the rest of the world and to sign no entangling alliances. Now, as with most historical myths, these contain elements of truth. But in reality, the United States was never as isolated and anti-imperialist as is commonly believed. Indeed, it has been a highly expansionist power, always involved with the rest of the world. Illustrative of the difference between the myth and the reality here is the fact that Washington, in the farewell address, never proposed isolationism, and as president, he never practiced it. He never even used the word isolationism or the expression no entangling alliances in his farewell address. The common belief that he did so is yet another myth. In this lecture, we will explore the realities as opposed to the myths of American isolationism and American imperialism. We do have a problem here, semantic one. Both isolationism and imperialism have multiple meanings, and we will need to clarify in this lecture what those different definitions are, which definitions Americans in the past used, and which ones we are using in this lecture. Now, clearly, the original 13 colonies that became the United States were founded in the 17th century as part of an expanding British Empire. And in the next century, they rebelled against that empire and its monarchical form of government. But that does not mean that they rebelled against the concept of empire. Interestingly, one of our first military acts in the Revolutionary War was the attempted conquest of French Canada in 1775 in an effort to make it the 14th state. That was an effort that ended in failure at Quebec at the end of the year. In the 1783 peace treaty ending the war with England, the United States acquired not only what had been the 13 colonies east of the Appalachian Mountains, but also the huge territory between those mountains and the Mississippi River. The Founding Fathers did not see the Mississippi as the final boundary of the United States. They often referred to the nation as, quote, our rising empire. Thomas Jefferson talked about this, quote, empire of liberty. What they had in mind was an expanding entity, but one that would not acquire formal colonies, colonies that might eventually rebel against them as they had rebelled against England. Instead, land that was acquired would gradually be incorporated into the Union on an equal political basis, first as an organized territory, then as a state, once an area had enough white settlers. This pattern was first established under the Articles of Confederation in the Northwest Ordinances of the 1780s. Those ordinances would serve as a model for American expansion across the entire North American continent over the next 50 years. And that expansion took place by both war and treaty. Treaty, the Louisiana Purchase of 1803. Florida, Andrew Jackson's invasion, followed by a treaty during the years 1819 to 1821. Texas, rebellion by settlers against Mexico in 1836, and annexation in 1845. California and the Southwest via war with Mexico from 1846 to 1848. Oregon by treaty, albeit with the threat of war, in 1846, and the Southwest Gadsden Purchase by treaty in 1853. There were also continued and consistent attempts to conquer and annex Canada from the War of 1812 onwards. And of course, all of this expansion was accompanied by dispossession of the Native American tribes who had inhabited the land. Now, Americans did not call any of this imperialism because of the political equality granted to settlers in the new areas as opposed to colonial status. In addition, Americans saw the entire continent as theirs by divine right, as can be seen in the expression manifest destiny in the 1840s. But others, Native Americans, the Spanish, Mexicans, Canadians, did not see it that way. They saw it as aggression, subversion, and imperialism. It's important to note that colonialism is not the only form of imperialism. There are other, more informal forms of domination, of one area over another and one people over another. In this regard, I think it's interesting to note that both the Southern secessionists before and during the Civil War and the populace of the Midwest and Great Plains, as well as the South in the 1880s and 90s, both the Southern secessionists and the populace defined their sections as economic colonies of the Northeast, despite the supposed political equality within the entire Union. Now, this expansion across the entire North American continent was hardly isolation, nor was the 1823 Monroe Doctrine, asserting that the entire Western Hemisphere was henceforth to be considered off limits to European colonialism, while it remained open to continued American expansion. Is that isolationism? Not unless one again uses the American belief in manifest destiny, this time to expand across Central and South America as well as North America. Nor was the expansion of American commerce throughout the world in the late 18th and 19th centuries isolationism. Commercial expansion with Europe, with Latin America, and with Asia, this would include the opening of Japan in 1854 and other Asian areas throughout the 19th century, were hardly moves of isolationism. Was there an American isolationism? Yes. But it was limited to non-participation in Europe's numerous military alliances and wars. Something many Americans had come to the United States to escape, and something they saw as being made possible by two factors. The first was what Jefferson had referred to in his first inaugural address, the fact that geographically the United States was separated by thousands of miles of ocean from what he labeled, quote, the exterminating havoc of one quarter of the globe. The second factor was the American belief that their expanded commerce was a way to avoid war, and that indeed it was a rational alternative to war. In reality, however, commerce could be, and often was, a cause of war. We can clearly see that in the American Declaration of War against Great Britain in 1812, because of British violations of America's commercial neutral rights via seizures of American ships and goods, as well as the seizure of American citizens via impressment of sailors on the high seas. In point of fact, Americans viewed both this throttling of their commerce and simultaneous British support for Indian tribes in the Old Northwest as a conscious effort to halt the expansion of the United States, both landed and commercial, to throttle this new American empire and to destroy it. Commerce as a cause of war is also obvious in the declaration of war against Germany in 1917 for violation of, again, of our commercial neutral rights on the high seas, this time via submarine warfare. And in retrospect, the major reason we did not go to war with a European world power in the 105 years between the end of the War of 1812 and our entry into World War I, Spain was hardly a major power in 1898. The main reason we did not go to war with a major power during this time period was the fact that British balance of power politics maintained overall European peace, and that precluded the emergence of any hegemonic continental power that could threaten us or lead to the outbreak of a general European war. Now, what about the war with Spain? Before we even get to the war with Spain, what happened to this expansionism? Well, sectionalism in the Civil War brought it to a temporary end during the 1850s and 1860s. But throughout the 1850s, numerous adventurers, known as filibusters, and supported by the U.S. government, attempted to conquer Cuba and portions of Central America. They failed, but the efforts were there. Within 2 years of the end of the Civil War, the United States had purchased the enormous Russian colony, which we know as Alaska. Interestingly, that is the first territorial acquisition by treaty that did not include a provision for eventual incorporation into the Union as a state. Alaska would be officially known as a possession, in reality, a colony. Then came the war with Spain in 1898, and the acquisition of the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico, as well as the annexation of Hawaii. Hawaii, where American settlers had a few years earlier overthrown the native Hawaiian monarchy. But much more extensive than this formal colonial empire was the informal empire that the United States created in Central America and the Caribbean in the aftermath of the war with Spain. That empire included protectorates over five nations in the Caribbean and Central America: Cuba, Nicaragua, Panama, the Dominican Republic, and Haiti. All five were nominally independent, but the United States controlled the economies, the finances, and the foreign policies of these countries, and it reserved the right to intervene militarily in each of them. And it did so. The pattern was first established in Cuba with the 1901 Platt Amendment. It was an amendment to a U.S. military appropriations bill. The Cubans had to agree to this amendment by treaty and add it to their constitution in order to get the U.S. Army off the island, the army that had helped to defeat the Spanish. The Cubans within the Platt Amendment had to agree not to incur indebtedness beyond their means and not to do anything else that might endanger their independence. They also had to agree to grant the United States a naval base, which became Guantanamo Naval Base, and to allow U.S. military intervention in the country. A year later, Cuba and the United States signed a commercial reciprocity treaty that linked the Cuban economy to the American economy in a dependent role. The way this was done was by granting Cuban sugar a lower tariff rate than the tariffs on sugar from other countries. What that did, of course, it allowed the Cuban sugar industry to prosper. But it reinforced the island's single crop economy and in effect made the entire Cuban economy dependent not only on sugar, but on a continuation of this lower American tariff, thereby giving the United States, in effect, control over anything it wanted in Cuba. Also, in 1903, the United States helped to organize and then supported a successful revolt in the Colombian province of Panama in order to obtain the right to build and fortify a canal through what was now an independent country. As Theodore Roosevelt famously stated, "I took Panama and let Congress debate it." Over the next decade, the United States would foist treaties similar to the Platt Amendment on Nicaragua, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic, as well as Panama. And it would intervene militarily in each of them. The Cuban military interventions occurred from 1906 to 1909, 1912, and 1917 to 1922. Nicaragua, it was 1909 to 1910, 1912 to 25, and then 1926 to 1933. Haiti, 1915 to 1934. The Dominican Republic, 1916 to 1924. The United States would also exercise financial supervision over the Dominican Republic, Haiti, Nicaragua, which did not end until 1941 for some of these countries. Now, careful examination of the map explains why these nations, as well as Puerto Rico, the Philippines, Guam, and Hawaii, became part of the formal and the informal American empire. Panama and Nicaragua held the two key potential routes for an interoceanic canal, what would eventually become the Panama Canal. Cuba, Haiti, the Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico controlled the Caribbean approaches to such a canal. They were also vulnerable to a feared European military intervention because of their chronic indebtedness and instability. What about Hawaii, Guam, and the Philippines? They were all stopping points for both commercial and naval vessels needing to resupply. Ships at that point ran on coal, and you needed to resupply your coal. There were coaling stations and stops for other provisions on the route across the Pacific to the fabled China market of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Now, the American policy of free trade, most clearly enunciated in the open door notes of 1899 and 1900 regarding China, also promised and often led to further commercial expansion and domination of other areas. Given the enormous size and power of the American economy by this time, free trade, meaning free of tariff barriers, would almost inevitably mean that American goods were cheaper than those of any other power. The United States could simply produce those goods more efficiently given its awesome economic size. And if the United States controlled trade with certain areas, it would give the United States control of nations in Asia and Latin America, which had much smaller economies. As a famous late 20th century history doctoral examination question in Great Britain posed the issue, free trade is the imperialism of the strong. Discuss. Now, continuation of this commercial expansion during the years between the two world wars has led many historians to question the supposed isolation of the United States during this time period. Now, the United States Senate did reject membership in the League of Nations. But, as we will see in a later lecture, it remained very actively involved in the world during the 1920s, signing numerous treaties and expanding its economy globally. Indeed, the American economy undergirded the entire global economy of the 1920s, and with it, the entire peace structure of that decade. Now, both the American economy and the global economy collapsed during the 1930s. And with them went the peace structure. And admittedly, what both preceded and what followed that economic collapse is what one historian has accurately labeled a mood of isolation. But once again, it was a mood limited to a desire to stay out of another European war. And the closer Europe came to war, the stronger that mood became. It would change dramatically in 1940 and 1941 when Nazi Germany conquered virtually all of Europe. And it would result in the permanent demise of any isolationism whatsoever in this country. Indeed, after World War II, the United States would emerge as the most powerful and influential nation in the world, and indeed in world history. But as this lecture has hopefully shown, the shift was not nearly as dramatic as our national mythology would have us believe. Our past isolation has been grossly overstated, as has our anti-imperialism. Now, given this history, why have most Americans continued to maintain that we were once isolationist and almost always anti-imperialist? Partially, it stems from the fact that we successfully rebelled against the greatest empire in the world and thus believe we have an anti-empire tradition and history. Partially, it stems from the fact that our founders defined our empire, in Jefferson's words, as an empire of liberty, not an empire of tyranny, and we tend to equate the word empire with tyranny. Partially, it stems from the 19th century belief via the ideology of manifest destiny that the North American continent was ours by divine right, and thus our claims were superior to any contrary claims by Native Americans, Europeans, or Latin Americans. Our expansion by this mode of thinking across the North American continent could not be considered imperialistic. Along with that mode of thought went the belief that the entire Western Hemisphere was separated from Europe not only by an ocean, but by the republican form of government. The 1823 Monroe Doctrine was and still is consequently perceived as a defensive document against European encroachment. And thus, isolationist and anti-imperialist rather than expansionist and aggressive as others have interpreted it. Similarly, we believed we were liberating the Cubans in 1898. We also believed we were both defending and spreading freedom and democracy against mortal threats in World War I, in World War II, and in the Cold War. And partially, our belief that we were anti-imperialist stemmed from the fact that we equated imperialism with formal colonialism rather than viewing formal colonialism as but one form of imperialism. In addition, we have always viewed trade as a rational alternative to empire and war, which it can be, but which it often, as we have seen, is not. Now, a debate did begin during the Cold War as to whether we were indeed an empire. And if we were, then what kind of empire? That debate accelerated after the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. It was clear from that point on the United States was the hegemonic power of the world. So were we an empire if we were the hegemonic power? To most Americans, the answer remained definitely no. We are not an empire. Our major foreign policies, we are told consistently, are and always have been protection of our own security and promotion of democracy around the world, not the creation of an empire. But in the name of protecting our own security and promoting democracy, numerous critics point out that we have created and we consistently use the largest military force in the world. It is a military force whose total cost is greater than that of the armed forces of all other major nations combined. If that is not imperialistic, the critics asked, what is? There's another fact to consider. Isn't promotion of American-style democracy imperialistic to cultures that do not share or want our democratic values? On the other hand, isn't much of our previous expansion really the unplanned defensive result of our need to counter mortal threats to our security. Mortal threats that appeared first in the shape of aggressive European monarchies, and then in the shape of Nazi Germany and the Communist Soviet Union. Perhaps so. Perhaps so. But that does not negate the domination we have been able to exercise over others in the process of defending ourselves and ensuring our own security. And others clearly define that domination as imperialistic. Now, in truth be told, in a world of nation states that all claim sovereignty, and keep in mind that sovereignty includes the right to make war. In such a world, the only absolute security is expansion designed to preclude the emergence of any other center of power that could threaten you. Clearly, during the Cold War, that is the way we interpreted Soviet behavior, and in fact, all of Russian history. Realize that in this regard, one nation's defense is another nation's aggression. And that will be the case as long as we live in this anarchic international system in which every nation maintains that it is sovereign and maintains the right to make war on any other nation. Perhaps relevant here is what the ancient Athenians asserted to the Spartans 2,500 years ago about their empire, that is the Athenian Empire, at least according to Thucydides in his classic, The Peloponnesian War. The Athenians said to the Spartans that their principal motive in acquiring an empire was fear. Then Thucydides added, quote, though honor and interest afterwards came in. Are we all that different from the Athenians? Or indeed, are we all that different from ancient Rome, to which we are often compared by others, and indeed, to which throughout our history, we have often compared ourselves?
Lecture 14. Early progressives were not liberals.
Many Americans, whether liberal or conservative, trace contemporary liberalism back to the late 19th and early 20th century reform movement known as progressivism. Progressivism was a movement that began in the cities and that came to dominate both political parties and national politics during the first two decades of the 20th century. Indeed, at least two American presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, openly identified themselves as progressives and their programs with the progressive cause. Yet a close examination shows that the progressives held many views totally repugnant to contemporary liberals. Now, as with other historical myths that we've looked at, there is a kernel of truth in the supposed connection between progressivism and contemporary liberalism. But it has been grossly overstated, and it distorts the history and meaning of progressivism. It also distorts the meaning of contemporary liberalism and contemporary conservatism, for that matter. Part of the problem is that our definitions of liberalism and conservatism have changed rather dramatically over the past century, and they have done so more than once. But the problem is also due to a misunderstanding regarding who the progressives were and just what they stood for. This lecture will attempt to address that misunderstanding by analyzing the progressives and their progressive movement. After doing so, It will then explore the ways in which progressivism is related to contemporary liberalism and the ways in which it is not. Now, the confusion over progressivism is quite understandable. It was never a unified movement. It contained many different groups with many different goals. That fact is clearly illustrated by both the legislation that was passed during the progressive era and the four constitutional amendments that were passed during this time period. These constitutional amendments, numbers 16, 17, 18, and 19, established the income tax, direct election of senators, prohibition on the manufacture and sale of alcohol, and the vote for women. Now, what in the world, one might ask, do those four have in common? Situation is similar in regard to progressive legislation. Major progressive bills included establishment of the first income tax, bills to regulate the railroads, antitrust legislation, the Pure Food and Drug Act, the creation of the Federal Reserve System, major attacks on civil liberties during and after World War I, and immigration restriction. Again, one might ask, what in the world do these have in common? The progressive era would also see the creation of numerous professional organizations with enforced professional standards for doctors, for lawyers, for others. It would also see the rise of social work, social workers, settlement houses to help the immigrants and the poor. We'll also see the rise of a national birth control movement during this time, a further deterioration in the condition of African Americans, a major movement in the churches known as the social gospel movement promoting progressive reform, and a racist eugenics movement that sought to sterilize those it labeled inferior. Once again, what in the world do these have in common? The movement also elected two of our best-known presidents, Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. But they came from different political parties, and they had strikingly different personalities. They ran against each other in 1912 on two progressive platforms, but diametrically opposed platforms, and they came to hate each other. The progressive movement also included people famous in other areas of American life, but with little, if anything, in common. You had philosophers such as William James and John Dewey, the father of our modern educational system. You had social workers such as Jane Addams, who was also a famous peace activist. At the same time, you had army officers such as General Leonard Wood, who helped bring progressive efficiency to the army and who wanted to inculcate army values into the civilian population. You had ministers such as Walter Rauschenbusch and Washington Gladden, who were leaders in the social gospel movement. You had jurists such as Oliver Wendell Holmes and Louis Brandeis, highly influential Supreme Court justices who came from different generations. You had expose journalists called muckrakers by Theodore Roosevelt, such as Lincoln Steffens, Ida Tarbell. And you had novelists such as Stephen Crane, Theodore Dreiser, Frank Norris, Jack London, Upton Sinclair. You had imperialists such as Theodore Roosevelt, and anti-imperialists such as Robert La Follette. Roosevelt was also an avid internationalist, whereas La Follette is known as an isolationist. Nor is that the end of the contradictions and the confusion. Progressive programs included many ideas from the 1892 populist platform cited in a previous lecture, but most progressive leaders had been anti-populist in the 1890s. Most progressives wanted to regulate big business, but numerous business leaders were part of the movement. Many immigrants supported the movement, even though many of its leaders were anti-immigrant. Many African Americans supported the movement, even though many of the movement's leaders were highly racist. and many women supported the movement, even though many of its leaders were proponents of legislation to protect women because of their alleged inferiority. Now, historians have for many decades explored progressivism and tried to understand these contradictions and this movement. Perhaps it is best described, in the words of one historian, Robert Wiebe, as a search for order, an attempt to redefine American politics and American society in light of the enormous, the revolutionary changes that had been created by the Industrial Revolution and the ensuing urbanization of the country. In this regard, a new class of urban white-collar professionals created by the Industrial Revolution and urbanization, accountants, clerks, mid-level managers, would join with the older urban professional middle class of doctors, lawyers, and businessmen to be two of the driving forces in the movement, though far from the only ones. Now, the essential progressive program focused on a series of general goals. One was to end the abuses of power and the corruption that had come to dominate American economic and political life. Progressives wanted to replace corrupted institutions with reformed ones that would restore power to the people via such measures as the initiative, so that the people could initiate legislation rather than the corrupt state legislatures, the referendum where people could vote directly on this legislation, and the recall whereby corrupt officials could be thrown out of office before the end of their term. Progressives also favored direct election of senators instead of via corrupt state legislatures, the secret ballot, and extension of the franchise to many previously denied it. Progressives also wanted to restore morality to American politics and American life. Honesty in business, honesty in government, honesty in production. Witness the Pure Food and Drug Act. Progressives wanted to help the victims of industrialization, children and women forced to work, the new immigrants, and others. Progressives wanted to use scientific and efficiency principles and expertise from both the academic world and the business world to minimize disorder and establish cooperation. In progressive minds, expertise and morality were fused. They were not contradictory, they were complementary. As Woodrow Wilson once said to the experts that joined him going to the Paris Peace Conference, a group known as the Inquiry, "Tell me what is right, and I will fight for it." The experts would know what was right, what was morally right, as well as what was factually right. Progressives also wanted to professionalize and regularize aspects of American life by establishing clear standards for doctors, lawyers, and other professionals. And finally, progressives wanted to restore a sense of discipline, virtue, and service, to get people to look beyond their narrow self-interest and look instead to the good of others and to the good of the country as a whole. The thought was best expressed by the philosopher William James in his essay, The Moral Equivalent of War. War, he believed, was hideous, but it did get people to think not first of themselves, but of the soldier next to them, beyond their own self-interest. If we could get the civilian population to think the way soldiers do, James said, it would be a great advance. General Leonard Wood felt similarly. He called for inculcating military virtues into civilian life. Now, for progressives, the key tool to do all of this was positive government action. This is the key shift in what we might call the liberal perspective. And the one very clear link, in fact, some would say the only clear link, between the progressives and contemporary liberals. a belief that government is not the problem, but the solution to the problems that plagued American life at this time. Now, traditional 18th and 19th century liberalism feared government power. It saw government power as the key source of tyranny throughout history, and it had sought to limit government power in whatever ways it could. Witness in this regard the policies that we have previously discussed of Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson. But progressives turned this traditional liberalism on its head by arguing that the large monopolistic corporations and the corrupt urban political machines had become the key problems, and that positive government action was now imperative to control big business, to reform the political and economic systems, and thereby to restore and save the American dream. Now, there is no central theorist for the movement, but one of the most important progressive thinkers was an individual named Herbert Croly, who wrote a book entitled The Promise of American Life. What Croly essentially did was to attack Adam Smith's hidden hand that laissez-faire would result in everything being rosy. The marketplace, he argued, was no longer self-regulating, and it was not leading automatically to better things in the economic sphere or in any other sphere. The belief that it was, Croly maintained, was actually helping to destroy the American dream. And what was needed to restore the promise of American life was greater government power. Nationalization, centralization. Or as one cliche to summarize the progressive movement put it, use Hamiltonian means for Jeffersonian ends. Now, while progressives tended to agree on these general goals and the positive use of government, they disagreed over just how government should be used. For example, should it be used in terms of regulating big business, to break down large monopolistic corporations, to smash big business, or should it instead merely seek to regulate them? This fact can be most clearly seen in the competing progressive platforms of Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson in the presidential election of 1912. Wilson's New Freedom sought to use the government to break up big business in order to restore competition. Roosevelt's New Nationalism argued that this was both impossible and counterproductive. Instead, government should seek to control and legitimize big business. Government should also play the key role as arbitrator in differences between business and labor. Now, far from accidentally, this indirect attack on laissez-faire also led the New Nationalists to propose legislation to help the victims of industrialization, since these people, in effect, recognized that laissez-faire was not working and that some people would need government help. Now, those who opposed the progressive call for positive government action would henceforth be considered conservatives. But in actuality, they were retaining one of the major principles of 18th and 19th century liberalism, fear of government power. In that belief, these American conservatives were diametrically opposed to traditional European conservatives, who favored strong government power, indeed some favored absolute government power. It is important to realize in this regard that American conservatives and liberals both base their belief systems on John Locke's concept of the social contract, as was discussed in an earlier lecture. So do those who consider themselves neither conservatives nor liberals, but moderates. None of them follow the concepts of Thomas Hobbes and other European conservative thinkers that underlay the very different European definition of conservatism. Hobbes had maintained that the natural, original state of human life was, in his words, quote, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. And that the only way to organize a society so as to overcome this was to give total power and obedience to a monarch or to a small aristocratic group empowered to decide every issue. Now, while some American conservatives just might agree with Hobbes's pessimistic view of human nature, they do not agree with his proposed solution of absolute obedience to a powerful, centralized, authoritarian government. Instead, they argue, as did 18th and 19th century liberals, that strong centralized government, not big business, remains the greatest threat to freedom. This fear of big government has led to the crack that an American conservative is actually a worshiper of dead liberals. If that is true, does that make a liberal a worshiper of dead conservatives? It is also important to note that while the logic of progressive thought does lead to many programs contemporary liberals could support, it also led to many programs that are anathema to contemporary liberalism. Let me name but a few of these. A desire to help the victims of industrialization, which contemporary liberals would applaud, combined with the desire to restore morality to American life, translated during this time period into an imposition of middle-class American morality via legal social coercion in numerous areas. Some have argued that that is something that contemporary conservatives might support as well. Another link of conservatives to the progressive movement. The Prohibition Amendment, as well as laws against certain drugs that were passed during this time period, were partially justified on the grounds that alcohol and drugs are immoral and that they create dependency that holds back the working class. In this mode of thinking, social reform becomes social control as the government assumed functions previously performed by the church, by the family, and by the local community. The desire to help the victims of industrialization would also lead to a major movement to Americanize the new immigrants at the expense of their traditional cultures. Now, destroying traditional cultures may seem to us as anything but helpful to new immigrants, but that is because our values in this regard have changed so dramatically over the last century. Today, our belief in this regard is aptly summarized by Star Trek's prime directive, not to upset or alter the cultures of other life forms with whom the Enterprise comes into contact. But the belief then was that the best thing you could do for the new immigrants was to make them think and behave just like middle-class white Americans. Furthermore, the progressive emphasis on science, on expertise, and on professional standards actually hurt the new immigrants and other poor by depriving them of the doctors, lawyers who had been willing to serve them. While those individuals might not have been very well trained, at least they were willing to provide service to the poor. Similarly, progressive efforts to destroy political corruption deprived the new immigrants and other poor of the urban political machines that took care of them, in return, of course, for their vote and acceptance of the graft that went with these machines. Tammany Hall's George Washington Plunkett had admitted years earlier to a reporter that he knew every man, woman, and child in his district, and when there was a fire or some other emergency, he didn't ask questions as reformers would, get them to fill out forms. Instead, he found them a place to live, got them clothing to replace what they had lost, and they gratefully repaid him with their vote. The fusion of science with pre-existing racism would reinforce the desire to help the new immigrants by Americanizing them and destroying their native cultures. It would also lead to immigration restriction to prevent any more of these inferior peoples from coming over and competing with American labor. That fusion of science with pre-existing racism would also lead to the rise of a movement known as eugenics, and with it calls for forced sterilization of inferiors so as to improve the genetic base of the population. Indeed, this progressive era might very well have been the height of scientific racist thought in this country. It would witness in this regard the publication of Madison Grant's notorious Passing of the Great Race, soon followed by Henry Ford's previously cited anti-Semitic tracts. Nor is it accidental in this regard that the great progressive Woodrow Wilson would expand segregation in the federal government, introducing it to several departments where it had not existed before, and that he would praise D.W. Griffith's racist film, Birth of a Nation, as, quote, history written with lightning. Now, this racism, along with the emphasis on the imposition of American middle-class standards of expertise and morality, would also lead many progressives to become avid imperialists in the name of what Rudyard Kipling had popularized as the white man's burden, the need to help these inferior peoples by ruling them. It is no accident in this regard that the progressive era coincides with the establishment, as discussed in the last lecture, of the informal as well as the formal American empire. In fact, most of the military interventions in Central America and the Caribbean occurred during the progressive era, under both the Republican Theodore Roosevelt and the Democrat Woodrow Wilson. And the progressive emphasis on nationalism and centralization would reinforce, if not create, the suppression of civil liberties during World War I in the name of patriotism. It was done via creation of the first American Propaganda Bureau, the Committee on Public Information, and the passage of the Espionage and Sedition Acts in 1917 and 1918. Those laws virtually outlawed dissent against the war and criticism of the United States government, and they would be supported by the Supreme Court. Indeed, Eugene Debs would be jailed again under these laws, this time for opposing the war. In addition to all of these problems, much progressive legislation simply failed. Big business today is in many ways more centralized and destructive of competition than it was 100 years ago. Big government has in many ways failed as well, failed to do what it promised. And to many today, whether rightly or wrongly, big government appears worse than the problems it originally grew to address. Fascinating is the fact that progressive political reforms would coincide with a decline in the percentage of Americans who vote, not an increase as the progressives had desired and expected. Nevertheless, progressivism created much of the broad value structure that we live with today, whether liberal, conservative, or in between, regarding such issues as efficiency, expertise, morality, government control, as well as the inculcation of such values through our educational system. We still use the word progressive. In this regard, we are in a situation similar to the continued use of the word populism. Do contemporary people who use the label progressive have anything in common with the original progressive movement? The answer is probably similar. This is not a lecture on contemporary progressivism, but as with populism, there are links, but there are dramatic differences. What I think can be clearly stated is that most, if not all of us, liberals, conservatives, moderates, progressives, remain linked to progressive ideas. And progressivism thus remains very relevant to contemporary American life. But it does not necessarily remain relevant in the ways that we think it does.
Lecture 15, Woodrow Wilson and the Rating of Presidents.
Woodrow Woodrow Wilson is one of the most controversial presidents in all of U.S. history. In most presidential polls, he is put in either the great or the near great category. Yet to his numerous detractors, both at the time and later, he is vastly overrated. Now, examining the reasons for this sharp difference of opinion provides an opportunity to explore the broader issue of presidential ratings in general and the standards by which past presidents are judged. Wilson's reputation and high rating in the polls rests upon what appear to be an extraordinary series of accomplishments during his 8 years in office. A former professor of political science and then president of Princeton, Wilson possessed exceptional intelligence, knowledge, and rhetorical abilities. He used these to promote and obtain passage of his New Freedom progressive program. This included, during his first 2 years in office, the Underwood-Simmons tariff, which was the first major downward revision of the tariff since before the Civil War. It also contained the first income tax in American history. Congress also passed the Federal Reserve Act, establishing the Federal Reserve System. This was our first central banking structure since Andrew Jackson destroyed the Second National Bank of the United States in the 1830s. Congress also passed the Federal Trade Commission Act, which established the Federal Trade Commission, and the Clayton Antitrust Act to curb monopolistic business practices. But that was not the end of it. Wilson then expanded his reform program so as to obtain passage in 1916 of a second round of progressive legislation. You had the Federal Farm Loan Act and Warehouse Act to provide farmers with credits. A Highway Act to help construct and improve rural roads. The Owen Keating Act prohibiting the interstate shipment of goods made with child labor. You also had the Adamson Act, establishing an 8-hour day for railroad workers. And the Kern-McGillicuddy Act, which created a workman's compensation system for federal employees. That's impressive. And in obtaining this collection of progressive legislation, Wilson also became the first president to propose and obtain from Congress a full program. He was also the first president to address Congress personally and use his rhetorical abilities to get what he wanted, since George Washington and John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, had ended that practice. Wilson also exhibited exceptional political skill, both with the Congress and with the public. And by 1916, he had united progressive forces from both parties to support him for re-election. In foreign affairs, Wilson's supporters argue, he kept the United States out of World War I for nearly 3 years. And when forced by German actions to enter the war in the spring of 1917, he quickly became the moral leader of all the Allied nations and the major force for reform of the entire international system. That reform program, as enunciated in his 14 points address and other major speeches, focused on creating a new world order, a world order to be based on the creation of a League of Nations and the principle of collective security. In the past, peace had been maintained by the balance of power. And that balance of power had failed numerous times, most obviously during World War I. Wilson argued that the world should now ditch the balance of power and replace it with an international institution, the League, and a system whereby all nations would unite to stop any aggressor state. This would be collective security. Now, Wilson obtained his League of Nations and much of the rest of his international program during his intense negotiations with Allied leaders in Paris. But he failed to obtain Senate ratification of the ensuing Treaty of Versailles. According to his supporters, that was because of Republican obstructionists and because of a major stroke that tragically prevented him from successfully mobilizing the American people.